My name is Jackie Devoy. I'm a freelance journalist. I've been working in the mainstream full time since 1985, so that's 38 years now. And I started working for magazines, mainly teenage and women's magazines, and did bits and pieces for national newspapers. And as time has gone on, I've done more for the papers. But still carried on doing stuff for magazines as well. So yeah, it's been going on a long time.
Yeah, so which papers, and what was your experience like doing that?
Okay, I've pretty much always been freelance. I think I did a couple of stints in offices and as a freelancer and as a full-time member of staff just for short periods. Back in 1985, I did a week on the News of the World, which kind of really put me off working in newspaper offices, to be honest, because it was just, not my kind of thing, to be honest.
Yeah, but some journalists are quite like that because it's got such a massive reach. And also, you know, these sensational type stories, you know, some journalists really like doing that kind of tabloidy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind doing it, to be honest, for a long time. As the years went by, I kind of wanted to stick to light-hearted, fun stuff. It just seemed to just be easier to do and pay better. And so I made a point of sticking to doing that for quite a long time. And it was probably only around 10 years ago that I started to get more involved in serious issues such as vaccines. I started working with David Icke at The People's Voice. He set up a new internet TV station back in 2013. So I started working there with him and the gang, and people were, I was helping produce the Richie Allen news show. So I was dealing with more sort of news issues then. And that's how I kind of got into doing more serious stuff. That's when people started contacting me about vaccine injuries, which had never really crossed my mind before that point.
No, but I mean, Ike is quite a controversial figure in himself, isn't he? In that, you know, there are quite a lot of stories that he rolls out that are quite easy to ridicule, like this sort of reptile thing. I mean, you know, you can obviously see how someone, you could liken someone or have a sort of metaphor saying someone is a reptile, but the idea that they actually are. But so what was that like working under almost like your sort of super editor or manager being David Icke?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, he's a really nice person. A lot of people ridicule him, but most of those people have never read a single one of his books. They've never spoken to him. They don't know him as a person. They usually heard through the grapevine. He even laughs about himself when people say, oh, he thinks the Queen's a reptile. That's not what he said at all. The Queen's a lizard. That's it. It's like anyone, unless you know them, you don't know the full story. He's been spot on about loads of things. He's a very interesting person. He's very well read. He's got a massive brain and a huge ability to dot connect, which is something that a lot of people don't seem to have, where he can just see everything in a very broad sense and bring it all together and work out what's going on. I mean, he hasn't been wrong about anything so far, as far as I can see. And he's a very interesting and intelligent and kind person. Actually, I speak to him quite regularly.
Okay, so what was it that you fixed onto during the pandemic that you really kind of decided to concentrate on, focus on, to get to the bottom of?
Well, I was expecting the pandemic. It was like, yeah, because you know I'd been awake for quite a long time. I knew what was coming. You know, I'd looked into Operation Lockstep, which came about in 2010, and Event 201, obviously, which was a few months before they officially announced the faux pandemic. So once you're kind of aware of all that, you're like, it's just a matter of time when it's going to happen. So when it happened, it was like not a surprise in the slightest. Knew how it was going to go. Knew it was all a hoax. So I wasn't worried in the slightest about any of it. I suppose at the time, my dad was in a care home, and so I was kind of focused on that. He'd had a massive stroke, quite possibly from the flu jab that he'd had in 2019, and so I was kind of focused on him getting better. He was in hospital for a long time, then he was in a care home, and then when the lockdown happened, the first lockdown in March, I discovered that my dad had a DNR, which is a do not resuscitate order, on his medical file, which I thought was strange because he was only a young man. He was 76 at the time, and he was recovering from a stroke. Apart from that, he was in great health. And I thought, well, why is there a DNR on this person? It turned out there was a blanket DNR in most care homes at that time, which was a government policy. And so basically, if anyone stopped breathing for whatever reason, they would just be left to die. And I said, well, I don't really want my dad to have one of those. You know, what if he chokes on his porridge in the morning? You know, are they just going to let him choke to death? Or what if he has any kind of breathing issue? Are they not going to help him? So I spoke to people at the care home, the manager, and also the GP that used to visit the care home. And they explained to me that, oh, pretty much everyone in the care home has one of these, as if I'm supposed to accept that. And I said, well, we don't want one. And they said, well, it's not really up to you. And I said, well, I think it is, actually, because, you know, with these DNRs, you have to have the patient's consent. If they don't have capacity, which they were saying my dad didn't, they said he had vascular dementia, which I was never 100% sure about because he didn't seem to have any kind of issues to me in that department. And they said that, you know, that it would just be put in place without anyone's consent. And I said, well, that sounds wrong. So I looked into it. And yeah, the rules had been changed so that a consultant could override the wishes of the patient or the patient's family at that point in time, which I thought was terrible. I argued with them and they said, no, they weren't going to remove it. So after a few months, I managed to get my dad out of the care home, which is quite a thing to do because a lot of people no one was allowed to visit for most of the time my dad was in a care home. But I said, if they didn't have my dad ready to be collected the next day, I would, this was in September 2020, I would actually take them to court for false imprisonment of my dad and for a violation of his human rights and my human rights, because there was no law to say that care homes had to shut down. There was no law to say people couldn't visit. The fact of the matter was they'd locked their doors so you couldn't physically get in. Anyway, they knew this. Most people in the world didn't know this, definitely not in the UK. Even though I tried to tell as many people as possible, go and get your loved ones out of the care home if you can, and you can visit them. You can, it's difficult when the doors are locked, but you can, you know, make a stand and say that they're breaking the law. And if people had looked at the government website at the time, they actually said, with regards to care homes, that care home managers must make it possible, however they can, for visits to happen, because they knew that it was against people's human rights to be separated from their loved ones. So, but people didn't look at the government website. All they did was listen to the telly and listen to the radio and read the stupid newspapers, which by then were pumping out propaganda left, right and centre in support of this government narrative that everyone had to be locked in their homes, which again is a violation of human rights.
Well, to be fair, I mean, there were a few voices around saying, hang on, this is barbaric.
There were lots of them, and I was one of them. And the whole thing was ridiculous, you know, being forced to have their businesses shut down or they'll be penalised. All of it was unlawful. Every single thing they did was unlawful. But it wasn't the government doing it. The government were very, very sneaky and careful about making sure that on the websites, you know, they were saying that this was all a sort of a voluntary thing that people were doing. There was even a talk, I think, in 2021 in the Houses of Parliament, I can't remember which MP it was, just saying, well, we didn't tell the schools to shut down. We left it to the discretion of the head teachers. They chose to do it. So, you know, from the start, I knew they were going to throw people under the bus. Same goes for the doctors and nurses. Same goes for care home managers.
Well, I think a lot of it was the local authorities, for example, with the schools, and the same with the hospital trusts, with the, you know, individual hospital managers basically doing what they're told by the people who pay their wages.
But the government were very careful in covering their own sorry asses because they knew that they couldn't insist on these regulations and rules being put into place because they were like you say barbaric, inhumane, and in violation of the Human Rights Charter. So but people believed the news, people believed the newspapers, and people believed, you know, what they were hearing coming out of their radios and televisions. So, and a lot of people wouldn't hear any different. And I think a lot of people really enjoyed it. I know it sounds a bit peculiar, but people who weren't suffering, you know, horrible separations from their loved ones, and people who were being furloughed. I mean, I didn't get paid for anything, obviously, because I'm not, I don't work for a company, any one company. But, you know, I knew plenty of people have it sitting out in the sun, coughing Chardonnay in their gardens, and being paid, you know, full wages for not doing anything.
Well, there's
They're
also
having a
this
lovely time.
aspect of people actually. I mean, we live in a very, very atomized society where people kind of divided in their boxes, and the idea that everyone's suddenly pulling together gives people a kind of sense of purpose. So there was a sort of almost a subconscious appeal to people's sense of community, which has been, you know, many people have been alienated from in previous years.
Yeah, like the old wartime effort. I mean, I think whilst that was happening, that there was also a lot of division occurring, as we know, because a lot of people were saying, you know, what's going on here? I'm not standing for this. I wear a bracelet at all times which says I do not comply, and I don't, you know, I'm never going to comply to especially unlawful rules that they're trying to impose on people. So yeah, I think a lot of people were trying to stand up and speak out and saying, look, this is all wrong. And then, of course, that was causing division with the people who were having quite a nice time. And I think a lot of them, it wasn't just the whole thing about, you know, all pulling together. I think a lot of people couldn't care less about that, to be honest. I think it was the drama. I think a lot of people really enjoyed the drama. You know, people who've got slightly boring lives, maybe nothing really going on, get up, go to work, go to sleep. Suddenly there's all this stuff to talk about. There's all this drama, you know, the spying on the neighbours, you know, who's wearing a mask and who's not wearing a mask. And I think a lot of people really secretly, or even not secretly, were enjoying that.
Yeah, but hang on, because we've just left the story of your dad in his care home. There are millions in care homes who just were not getting any visits whatsoever from their family. Almost, well, I mean, they were isolated, incredibly isolated,
They were.
and this obviously there's vulnerabilities associated with that.
Yeah, I went to see my dad as often as possible, quite a lot. The window visits were just absolutely ridiculous because obviously they wouldn't open the front door. So I went round. Luckily, he was on the ground floor, and so I was able to go around to the window. He would get up and open the window, and we'd just lean on the windowsill chatting like that. He'd hold my hand through the window. One day, a carer came in and said, oh, no, you can't have the window open. And I said, what do you mean? Don't be ridiculous. She said, no, the window's got to be closed. I said, what, are you worried about the COVID's getting in or the COVID's getting out? She was like, well, you just can't have the window open. And I said, well, we're keeping the window open. So she went to close it, and I wouldn't let her. And then she's, and then I said, how am I going to speak to my dad if the window's shut? And she said, well, you can phone him. And I said, well, no, you've lost his phone. You've lost three of his phones, in fact. I said, and also, I'm not talking on the phone to my dad through a glass window like he's in prison. I said, that is like exactly how prison visits are, and he's not in prison. And I must say, I got my dad out of there. It was 10 months before I actually got him out. That was way too long, because in that time he became very depressed. He couldn't really understand. He kept saying, why am I locked in, you know, as anyone would ask. Not because he was confused or had dementia, but because that's a reasonable question for anyone to ask. Why can't I go out? You know, why am I locked in? Why can't you come in? And I said, Dad, it's ridiculous, and it's unlawful, and I don't know, and I'm looking into it for you. And so I got him out quite easily when I put my mind to it. I just thought, I'm not having him being locked in anymore. But I got him home, and while he was happy to be home, he was never the same. He was very depressed and very anxious. He had this weird kind of survivor's guilt where he was worried about the people who were left in the home, and even the carers. He was like, they're going to be really missing me, some of the carers. And I said, yeah, I'm sure they are, you know. And I phoned one guy that my dad was very close to, one of the carers, and said, if you want to come and see my dad at his house, you're welcome to. And he said, yeah, I will. He never did, but he kind of intended to. And we did. He chatted
Well, I
with my
think a
dad
lot of
on
these
the phone.
carers are actually really, they're, I mean, I'm not sort of, obviously not all of them are just looking at the bottom line to them. It's just a 9 to 5 job.
Yeah, absolutely. And the care home my dad was in was a reasonably nice one, you know. They did a lot of his clothes went missing. A lot of and this is something quite common that I hear from people with family members in care homes, that their jewellery goes missing, you know. And in nastier care homes, they have things stolen, such that, like their teeth, their false teeth, and their glasses, and their hearing aids. You know, they make them as vulnerable as possible, which is just dreadful. And this is a common thing, and there's a lot of cruelty and nastiness in a lot of care homes. Luckily, my dad's wasn't that bad, although they did lose, you know, if I bought them in a lovely new jumper from Marks and Spencer's and got it delivered, it wouldn't have, you know, it would just disappear. A lot of his new clothes went missing.
Well, this is not a very good atmosphere, isn't it? And I know that you started looking into some of the end of life care treatments, which really did seem designed to, well, dispatch people. And of course, this was all happening behind closed doors. Can you can you go into that a bit and how how you got onto that one?
Yeah, I did quite a few interviews around this time, and David Icke wanted to interview me about what was going on in the care homes, because I had been quite outspoken about it. This was in December 2020, after I got my dad out, and I had a few articles published in the Telegraph about, you know, getting my dad out of the care home, which I was amazed that they actually decided to run. In fact, they ran one of the articles twice, because I think there was another lockdown in the November, and they ran it again. They ran it in the September and the November, and I did a kind of series of articles, and the final one I did for them was what it was like trying to look after an elderly person at home once you'd gotten out of a care home, because that I hadn't really thought that through, and that wasn't easy. You know, I thought I can do it on my own, but I actually couldn't, so I had to get my dad carers in the end. But I did try for a couple of weeks looking after him, and it was not as easy as I thought it was going to be. So I did an interview with he interviewed me for one of his podcasts, and after that I was approached by quite a lot of people, and one man came to me saying that his loved one had been killed in an NHS facility. I'm being vague about it because he's actually in the middle of a massive court case at the moment. It's coming to the end of his court case, and if his court case succeeds, it will set a precedent for everyone else. So I can't really say too much about it at the moment because it's it could jeopardize the case. But so he came to me, and his loved one had just been murdered in cold blood in front of another relative. And if I hadn't been the sort of person that I am, and if I hadn't known what was going on, I wouldn't have believed him, because it sounds completely insane, you know. Nurses wouldn't kill an elderly person, you know, in cold blood in front of their relatives. But that's exactly what happened in this case. So I started to look into it and talk about it, and more people came forward. And I thought, this is happening everywhere. These people and then it transpired, you know, they're all being given the same cocktail of drugs. Then we found out that a protocol had been put in place in on April the 3rd, I think it was, 2020, which was a COVID protocol for treatment of people who came into hospital presenting with respiratory issues. And this protocol involved the use of a benzodiazepine called midazolam, and an opioid, usually morphine, and they'd be used together concomitantly. Now, anyone who knows anything about pharmaceuticals would know that these two drugs should never be used together, because they cause respiratory depression, and if used in large enough doses, death. So this combination of drugs has been used for years on death row in America, and to actually execute people, criminals. And some states in America have withdrawn this method of this lethal injection because it's too barbaric, and it can take a long time to kill a person using these drugs, even when they're used in huge doses. Also, it's the most horrendous death. Although the person appears generally to be paralyzed from the outside, they are suffering inside. The breathing is becoming more and more reduced and depressed. and it's like slowly suffocating to death. It takes an average of 29 hours to kill a person on using this method. It can kill someone immediately, some people, and it can take longer than 29 hours. It can take days, over a week in some cases I've seen. So it's a horrible way to die. Yet they were using these death row drugs on the elderly, usually the elderly. Having said that, I've spoken to a lot of people now who have lost loved ones who aren't elderly at all. So they're using these drugs to literally euthanize.
I mean, have you any idea of the extent, the number of, thousands of people that this has been used on?
Well, it was all very muddied, wasn't it? Because they were misattributing deaths to COVID. So basically, anyone who was dying around that time, they'd say they had COVID put on their death certificate in the majority of cases. We even heard stories of people dying in road traffic accidents having COVID put on their
Yeah,
death certificate
we
because
certainly
they
had
had
here
death.
in Bristol. We had just about everybody that challenged their death certificate had it overturned and something else written on there. So I mean, I think what is at the back of this, Jackie, is this protocol. Now we hear quite a lot about protocols because the insurance companies, as I understand it, will only insure medical facilities. Obviously, hospitals, care homes all fall into these categories where you've got nursing going on. If the protocols are followed.
Yeah, exactly. So this initial protocol that was brought in early April 2020 was called NG163, and this is the midazolam and morphine protocol. And it was instructed that patients with agitation or respiratory problems were given these drugs. There was even a sort of a warning or word of advice on the protocol saying that, look, we know basically, we know that you think these drugs will cause respiratory depression, and they do. And you probably know, this is kind of to the nurses and doctors, probably know that this doesn't seem like a very good idea, but don't worry about that. Just do it anyway, basically. This is what this advice said on the protocol. So a lot of doctors and nurses were thinking, hang on a minute, these aren't the right drugs to give to someone with these issues, in the same way that it wasn't right to put people with these sort of symptoms onto ventilators. That ventilators are a very, very last minute sort of last resort attempt to help someone, but because 80% of people who go on ventilators die. So that's another way. The other thing they'd be using midazolam for, because midazolam is generally used for serious epilepsy and also for minor operations and surgery, and it's also used to get people on ventilators. So it was being used for that as well. In March, April 2020, I think it was the 27th of April, a huge order for extra midazolam because we're running out of it here. I think we had like a year's supply of it left in the UK. A huge order was put in April 2020 to a factory in France, and 2 years' supply was ordered and brought into the country, and that supply was used up in within 9 months. So it was being used excessively in that time, and at that time there was a spike in COVID deaths in care homes and hospitals amongst the elderly especially. So I was thinking, more and more people are coming to me with these stories, and I thought, well, they can't all be making it up, they can't all be mad. So I started looking into it and piecing it all together, and I thought, this has got to go to the national newspapers because this is shocking, So I started speaking to the editors. I initially sent out an email and a pitch to 28 editors, and woke up the next morning thinking, oh, my inbox is going to be absolutely flooded. Why did I send it to 28 editors at once? This is ridiculous. And there was nothing. And I thought, well, that's strange. So I chased them up. One of them got back to me, said he was on holiday, get back to me. Another one said he'd pass it on to someone else, but there was nothing else. And I thought, this is really odd. So I started chasing them all individually, just enough tumbleweed, basically. And And I tried and tried and tried. I spoke to some of them in person, eventually on the phone. One of them, one editor said to me, it's not a story because it happens all the time. Everyone knows it happens all the time. I said, well, that could be the story, couldn't it? That euthanasia is going on in NHS facilities all the time. And this editor said, well, you know, everyone knows that when someone's really old and terminally ill, they're given a bit of a helping hand towards the end. And I said, can you hear what you're saying? You're saying that people are being killed because they're old or terminally ill. And she said, well, everyone knows that that's what happens. You know, they're made comfortable. They're like mercy killings. You know, everyone knows, everyone turns a blind eye. It's not a story. Now, euthanasia is illegal in the UK. Euthanasia, I don't even know why that word exists, because it's murder. If you euthanize someone, if you involuntarily euthanize them, it's called involuntary euthanasia. There's two types. Involuntary euthanasia is you killing someone, basically, and then you've got voluntary euthanasia, where they want to die and you help them. Which now the first ones, you can get a sentence of up to life imprisonment if you kill someone through euthanasia or whatever that might mean. Well, I know what it means. It comes from the Greek word euthanatos, which means a good death. And that's the title of the film that I eventually made, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. And if you assist someone, if you help someone to die, you can get 14 years in jail for that. So these things that the doctors are doing, hastening death, truncating someone's life, shortening their life. And as I pointed out to this editor, the problem is, I'm speaking to people whose loved ones were killed. They're not terminally ill and they're not old. So I set up a support group, a WhatsApp support group. And I've now got 74 people in it who've all been through the same, similar thing, where their loved ones were killed, in mainly in NHS facilities, hospitals, care homes, hospices, what have you. So I had a meeting. I got meetings with two editors, one from the Daily Mail, one from the Mail on Sunday. And at first they didn't believe it. So I brought the guy along with me who came to me initially. And by then he'd put together a massive file of documents, information, incontrovertible evidence that his loved one was murdered, and by doctors and nurses. And each of these meetings was about 4 hours long. And by the end of the meeting, their jaws were on the floor. They were like, this is massive, you know. I said, yeah, it needs to go in the papers as soon as possible, because as soon as we can get people aware of what's going on, there'll be absolute uproar and outrage, and we can put a stop to it. And they said, absolutely. I said to one editor, where would it be in the paper? He said, front page, obviously. This is front page. And we came up with the headline with COVID death pathway, right? And they took all the information with them. We did copies for them. They took the information. Well, these were two separate meetings, a few days apart. And then we liaised a bit after that. Then they just gradually went quiet. The guy from the Mail on Sunday spoke to a few of the people in my group, about four people, I think, and took lots of notes, and then went quiet. And when I chased him, he said, oh, look, I'm sorry, there's just not enough evidence. I said, what do you mean? There's a ton of evidence. These people have got all the evidence you need. And he said, yeah, we like the first bloke, but, you know, we could run his story, but he doesn't want his story run yet because he's, you know, going to court and stuff. And he's still keeping a low profile now, 3 years later. But once he wins his case, which I think he will, it's going to be massive. It's going to be absolutely huge. And they said, we'll wait till then. And I said, no, well, that's going to take years. And in the meantime, we need to put a stop to what's going on. Anyway, none of them ran the story. And I just thought, I don't know what to do with all this information. So when Jamie Icke approached me, this is David's son, he runs a media company called Iconic, and said, do you want to make a documentary? I jumped at the chance, obviously. So we made a film in 2021 called A Good Death, ? Because it's not a good death, obviously. And it's been seen literally all over the world by hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people now, because it's been out for a year and a half. And it premiered in December 2020. And I think it's a really good film. Now, there was a little part of me that was thinking we are actually going to be sued left, right, and centre because the claims that we're making in the film is that nurses and doctors, NHS medics, were killing people in their beds. I haven't heard a squeak out of anyone.
No, well, I think that's possibly because it was happening. I mean, you put me in mind of a recent series of films by Vera Sharaf from the
All right.
States.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen those. Never
No, I
Again,
haven't.
Never Again is now global, which is, I mean, she's Jewish. She's referring to the
Yeah,
Holocaust.
I know who she is. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, we're looking here at what is effectively one of the greatest crimes against humanity since the Holocaust. And one of the, is it Andrew Bridgen, MP, of course, has been actually suspended as a Conservative MP for saying that.
Yeah, I'm seeing Andrew Bridgen next week, not next week, the week after. So he has been informed about all this. We've kept him informed, and he's taken it on board as well. He's spoken out about it a couple of times. But you see, the problem is now he is known by the general public as a disgraced Tory MP,
Well,
fallen
I
from
think the
grace.
papers, yeah. I mean, that's quite a lot of members of the public will be, admiring what he's been doing. He's actually got quite a following too.
Oh, he has. Yeah. So there are a lot admiring him, but more that if you mentioned Andy Bridgen, 90% of people go, who? If you stop, if you did some street interviews, and the rest of them would go, don't know anything about him, or, oh, isn't he that Tory MP that got sacked for comparing the vaccine injuries to a Holocaust? They don't know. Most people haven't got a clue. And because, these things aren't properly reported on in the mainstream. And sadly, most people are glued to their TVs and still reading, the kind of mainstream propaganda. So, but hopefully he'll be able to help us in some way, because there are a lot of people being affected by this now. And a lot of people, after they watch my film, I say my film, I co-produced and presented it with Iconic Media, and it's free to watch as well on iconicmedia.iconic.com. I can send you a link to that later. So, a lot of people, once they've watched the film, they say, oh, I think that happened to my dad,
Well,
So,
this is the reason why it was so important in the first place to get these articles in the Mail on Sunday, is so
yes.
that people know what's going on. That's what the mass media is supposed to be there for. But they were kind of complicit with all of this. And you do look at, I mean, for example, this week we've got Boris Johnson being told he's got to hand over all of the
Yeah.
messages. Now, I wonder what's going on with all of that, because he was actually one of the only people who had been asking questions and pushing back against these protocols and the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, so he caved in on it all, and then he went over to stop the peace deal in Ukraine, so he's hardly an angel. But there are, I would imagine, much more interesting lines of inquiry for the COVID inquiry. I just wonder what you where you think they should be looking right now.
Well, they should definitely be looking into this mass genocide, but they just won't. And it's very interesting, because when I saw Isabel Oakeshott had done the lockdown files thing, it looked pretty contrived to me. But I thought, well, she might be able to help. And then I saw her on social media, on Twitter, saying that the Midazolam murders were a conspiracy theory. So I contacted her and said, I've made this film. It's definitely not a conspiracy theory. It's definitely going on. And she said, well, I don't believe it. And I said, well, so she replied. We had a good conversation. She said, I don't believe it. And I said, no, I understand why you don't believe it. Most people don't, because it's a really hard thing, to accept and get your head around that this is actually happening. And she said, well, and I said, I've got evidence. I said, would you watch my film? And she said, yes, I would. And she said, but no matter what evidence you give me, and no matter what it says in your film, I'm not going to believe that the government have been secretly killing off the elderly. And I said, it's not secretly, it's blatantly. And I said, just watch my film and then get back to me. I would say this was 2 months ago, maybe 2 or 3 months ago. And I messaged her a few times saying, have you watched my film yet? She said, oh, no, I've not had time. And then now she's gone completely quiet. But one thing did happen about 5 weeks ago. I messaged her again and said, look, can you let me know if you watched the film or not? And then I got an email from the editor, one of the editors at the Telegraph, saying, "Oh, we're kind of looking at this midazolam thing. Have you got any case studies?" And I'm like, "You know, I bloody have. I've got like over 60 people willing to come forward." Back in 2020, I had 16 people who said they would be willing to be photographed, interviewed, you know, identified, have names and addresses put in the paper. They just desperately wanted the story to come out. And the editor from the Mail on Sunday at the time spoke to four of them, I think. They told him the story and he just then just stopped talking to me. So 5 weeks ago, the editor at the Telegraph said, "Oh, can you send me a few sample stories?" She said, "We're especially interested in people who are going legal, because a lot of people are now, you know, it takes a long time." They're like, "What about the original guy?" And I said, "No, he still can't do anything because he," and they're like, "Why not?" It's like, these editors must know that, you know, certain cases cannot be talked about for fear of them being jeopardized. So they seem not to know that. So I sent them, I think, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 cases, and they said, "Brilliant, thank you. You know, we'll get in touch with these people." As far as I know, they haven't got in touch with them. I send an email every week to that editor saying, "How's it going?" Last thing I heard was 2 weeks ago. She said, "Oh, we're still working on it." Don't know what that means, because as far as I know, she hasn't contacted any of the people that I gave her the contact numbers for. So I don't know. Did Isabel Oakeshott get in touch with them and say, "Look, just can you, you know, contact this, do something with this woman, for God's sake, you know," because it's all being swept under the carpet, you know. Or maybe they'll do a tiny little piece on it and then think, "Oh, that, you know, that's it, done and dusted." At one point I messaged all the editors saying they were all complicit and they all have blood on their hands. They didn't lie that much. Well, they didn't reply. Well,
I'm sure they won't. No.
And recently this one editor, I said, "Why aren't you replying to my emails?" And she said, "Because some of your emails are very rude." And I said, "I've never, ever," I was always polite to her and said, "Oh, I didn't mean to come across as rude. I'm kind of to the point and a bit blunt and a bit brusque sometimes, but I'm never rude." They just don't like hearing the truth.
No, well, what they like is they like to surround themselves with sycophants.
Yeah.
They've got no background, have they?
No. And they, yeah, all a bit snowflakey. It's like, "Oh, I'm not going to speak to you because you're being rude." And it's like, "Oh, come on, you know, what are you?" Yeah. I'm an old school journalist, you know.
In the background to all of this, you say it's interesting your story about Isabel Oakeshott, because I'm sure, you know, there are all sorts of limits and barriers to what journalists can and can't get published. And of course, they've got lawyers in the background, many of these papers with full-time barristers looking at everything to try and stop things like, you know, and those barristers can be got at, they can be paid, whatever, bribed, I might even use that word, not to let certain stories through and come up with bogus legal reasons. But look, at the back of all of this is this whole idea of eugenics, of Malthusianism, yeah, of the idea that actually maybe people have a rather dark nature, and that actually mass murder, you know, and mass killing, even human sacrifice, is somehow deep in the human soul, as we saw back in the 1930s and 40s, particularly in Germany, that this is a part of human nature which sometimes comes out, Jackie.
Well, I mean, a lot of them have made no secret of the fact that they're the Malthusian eugenicists, you know, and that they're keen to depopulate. You know, Boris Johnson and his father, Stanley Johnson, have spoken openly about it. You know, they all believe that the world is overpopulated and that depopulation is the way forward. But they can't go out shooting people. So they're doing it in a more subtle way, and they're coming at us from all angles. You know, they're increasing the deaths of the elderly in the way I've just described. They're also, people are dying younger, even though a lot of people think we're dying older, because of medications, a lot of iatrogenic death going on. There are more people having terminations, there are more people, the more stillbirths, and all the medications and these things that they're bringing in, such as these mRNA injections under the guise of vaccines, which people are willingly taking, although they did have to be bullied quite a lot this time, they're still ultimately killing themselves, you know. So the governments aren't having to go out and actually do the dirty work. They just brainwash the people into killing themselves, which
well,
is
to be fair,
horrendous.
A lot of people, I mean, these boosters are going down like a lead balloon, aren't they?
Yeah, a lot of people have just kind of woken up, said, hang on, I've had five now and I don't want another one, you know, this can't be. And a lot of people are very, very ill from it now. Even I've noticed changes in people who've had the jabs who aren't ill as such. But one thing I've noticed is the ones who are saying, oh, I'm fine, I've had the jabs and I'm fine, they've aged. They look older. They've aged 10 years in the last three, you know, the last two years.
I was in a taxi the other day and the taxi driver was saying to me, he said, I wish I had never had the... He said, my health has just been slowly declining since I had the second jab and I wish I'd never had it. And I said, well, you can't de-inject this stuff. That's the problem. You know, it's a one-way decision. And I can remember actually as a kid having the TB BCG at school.
Yes, I remember. That's the last one I had, I think.
Yeah, we were all queued up and I'm sitting in this line thinking this is not necessarily a good idea, what the hell is this stuff? And it's a one-way journey, that's what I'm trying to say. But look, the most important in a way question I'll leave till last, which is how, or in fact it's two questions, which is how do you maybe pursue some sort of legal case and get on with that if you think perhaps one of your loved ones was treated in this way with midazolam? And the other thing I suppose is how do you know if one of your loved ones in a care home might still be vulnerable to this kind of thing?
Well, I'd say they're all vulnerable. It's still going on. It's really, really difficult. I mean, people in my group have taken separate routes. The sad thing was, while I was making the film, my dad was killed by a paramedic in his own bed at home. He'd had a bit of a breathing issue with his my dad used to have problems with swallowing and stuff sometimes, and sometimes he'd eat too fast and choke on his toast. So I think, I don't know what happened to him that morning, I wasn't there, but an ambulance was called and the paramedics spoke to me on the phone. I was next of kin, had power of attorney. I said, do not, I'm on my way, I'll be an hour, don't give him anything, don't inject him with anything, because I knew what they see an old man in a bed, it's like, okay, let's get rid of him. There were three very young paramedics in their 20s, and I said, do not inject him with anything, do not give him midazolam, do not give him morphine, he's not in any pain, he doesn't need those drugs, and don't inject him with anything until I get there and see him. They knew I was driving up the motorway, halfway up the motorway, I got a phone call from my daughter saying that he was dead. I spoke to the paramedics and I said, what's happened? What have you done? What have you given my dad? And they said, we haven't given him anything. I said, you've given him something because he was fine and now he's dead. What's happened? And they lied and said they hadn't given him anything. My dad's carer overheard them talking about midazolam and what dose they were going to give him. They swore blind they hadn't given him that. When I got the ambulance report, they'd given him an injection, apparently, of glycopyrrolidone bromide, which is the drug that stops death rattle. It reduces any secretions in the throat, basically. I told them not to inject him with anything, and they injected him with that. I think if that's what they gave him, he had a fatal reaction because he was dead within half an hour, and he died in a really horrible, undignified way. And I went to the police. I basically said, my dad's been, something happened. He was alive one minute, dead the next. I think he's some kind of, misadventure on the part of the, or malpractice on the part of the paramedics. The girl who injected him was 21 years old. I looked her up on social media. I know exactly who she is. I haven't contacted her, obviously. I thought I'll go down an official route. I went to the police. A lot of people have gone to the police, get absolutely nowhere. Yeah. When the police realise what you're suggesting, so after 8 months, the police contacted me and said, we're closing the case. And I said, why? They said, well, we've been down all avenues of investigation. I said, you haven't investigated at all. Mm. You haven't spoken to any of the witnesses. And they said, well, there weren't any witnesses, really, apart from the paramedics, because the paramedics had asked the other people to stand outside the door when they did what they had to do. And my dad's carer knew he'd been injected because she said when she went back into the room, he had his arm out over the covers, had previously been under the covers, and he had his sleeve rolled up to his shoulder. So she said, and I said to her at that point, check all the bins after the paramedics had left. I said, and they'd taken my dad's body away. She found a syringe wrapper in one of the bins. So, which proves a syringe had been taken out of a wrapper, that's all.
Good God, I mean, you know, this is the sort of thing that the police maybe back in the day would have taken very seriously, but now it's almost a daily occurrence. So,
I said to the police, do you want me to make a statement? Because I got the full story, you know, my conversation with the paramedics, and they said, no, we don't need a statement for you because you're not a witness. And I was like, well, sorry. And I said, okay, well, what about and I said what about a statement from my dad's carer? Because at the time she said she would make a statement because she was horrified. She chased the paramedics out to the ambulance saying, what did you give him, what's happened? And they said, we didn't give him anything, and they kind of ran off and left her there with my dad's body. And and she was like absolutely devastated. And so she said she'd do a statement. And the police said, no, we don't want a statement from her because she wasn't in the room when it happened. And I said, well, most people aren't in the room when a murder happens, just the victim and the person, the murderer, you know.
Quite clearly not doing their job. But look, what about, a bit of info for anyone listening who is maybe got their loved one in a care home? What are the questions to ask to find out if one of your loved ones might be under one of these protocols?
You can ask them, is there a DNR in place? It's sometimes called a DNAR, do not resuscitate order. You'll probably find that there is one in place. That makes it easier to bump off a patient if one of those is in place. In my dad's case, I said to them on the phone, there is no DNR. They decided that there was a DNR in place. They asked a member of my stepfamily who was there, is there a DNR in place? And she said, yes, there is. She was wrong, there isn't. They phoned my dad's GP and my dad's GP wasn't there. So they spoke to another doctor there who told the paramedics erroneously that my dad had cancer and that he was dying and that he was having end of life care. None of that was true. They acted upon that. I mean, even if that was the case, and it wasn't in my dad's case, that's no excuse to kill someone in their bed. So they obviously have some kind of instruction that it's okay, the person's end of life, if it's palliative care, they can inject them with these toxic killer drugs.
Okay, so I mean, if anyone is listening is interested in getting in touch with you, whether it's because they've had similar experiences or they need some advice about what to do about their loved one or whatever, what's the best way to do that, Jackie?
They can get me on my email, which is jackiedevoy@gmail.com, but I've been doing this for 3 years.
Spell that.
Jackie is JACQUI .devoy, DEEVOY @gmail.com. I've been doing this for 3 years. It's taken up 24 hours a day sometimes. I've not earned any money from doing it. I've done in excess of 50 interviews with various alternative news stations and channels, probably a lot more than 50, actually. I haven't counted them. And it's exhausting and draining. But what I can do, I'll reply to emails, and I will add people if they want to be added to the support group, because there's now over 70 people all helping each other and updating each other on their progress.
Well, that hopefully will take a little bit of the load off of you, you know, since obviously this is a massive problem. There are probably many thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people who've been directly affected by this, but just don't have the support that you're helping provide there.
Yeah, so I can add them to the group. And they can help each other. Well, it's been a lifeline for a lot of people, because a lot of people thought they were alone, and their families and friends were saying, oh, you're just grief stricken, you're mad, you're imagining things. Of course they weren't murdered, you know. But as time goes on, people are getting more and more documentation, more and more evidence. They're getting drug charts, they're getting the medical notes. It's very, very difficult to find a lawyer that will take it on. And it seems to me that the lawyers, the coroners, the courts, the police, and the hospitals all close ranks once they realise what's going on.
I'm reminded of the whole business with asbestos, because it took about 10 years for to actually even get the lawyers to take those cases on of people who died. Because I think that this is often because the implications, financial implications for the pharmaceutical industry in this case and for the legal profession, are colossal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it costs to take people to court. Very few lawyers would do a no-win, no-fee. They're hard to come by anyway. for a case like this, because they're thinking, well, what chance have we got up against all these giants, you know? So, a lot of people can't even start the process.
Well, that is, the problem is, sorry, but the problem is that, I mean, you look at Pfizer's activities in West Africa, for example, with one of the vaccines they were putting out there for meningitis, is they actually set aside a massive budget, over $1 million, for lawyers to fight anybody that tried to stop them using this experimental meningitis vaccine, which actually eventually the Nigerian government weighed in, booted them out of the country and sued them themselves.
I mean, most people, they don't have enough money to even start the process. I wanted to start a legal process recently over something quite separate, and I paid the initial couple of thousand just to get things looked at. Then the next stage was to get a barrister to assess the case. That'll be 3,500 on his own, and I said, no, I haven't got that money. So we had to just stop right there, can't go any further, you know. And it is harder and harder to get a no-win, no-fee lawyer. And like I said, to act against, the government, the NHS, the police, you know, they're not going to take it on.
What we're looking at here really is a breakdown in law and order, isn't it? There is no justice anymore, effectively.
Yeah. And it's, you know, even if you get to the very end stage, I mean, the man who is, you know, getting to the end of his court hearing, there's still a chance that the judge can just say nothing to see here, everything's fine. In the case with my dad, you know, the police just said it all looks above board to us, you know, all looks fine.
Nothing to see here. It's a terrible thing, that is what it's come to. But anyway, can you just remind people of your film, where to find it, and your email, please, Jackie?
Yeah, the film is called A Good Death. And you can find it at iconic.com, and it's free to watch there, iconic.com. It's quite easy to find. And my email address is jackie.devoy@gmail.com. And if you want to email me, if you want to be added to the WhatsApp support group, all I need is your mobile number, and I can add you, and you can talk to other people in the group who've suffered. I mean, they're all getting very angry now. This is the thing, very, very angry. And it's not a good situation. And more people are speaking about it. You know, it's been almost 3 years since I've been talking about it, and 2 years since I went public with it. In fact, the first Midazolam interview I did was with Gareth Icke on his show called Right Now. And that was on my birthday last year, June the 4th. So, and it's nearly my, not last year, sorry, 2021. And then I went on the Richie Allen show, and then it just escalated after that. I've been on lots and lots of different shows talking about it. There's so much more to talk about, you know, how once the protocol NG163 was being talked about a lot on social media, they changed it to NG191 and kind of turned it from I think it was originally a 25-page document into a 400-page document, and kind of buried the word midazolam in there. You know, we're using other similar benzodiazepines.
This is what they call in the crime films, the old black and white crime films, is a cover-up. Anyway, yes. Look, Jackie Devoy, thanks ever so much for joining us and sharing all that. And well done for all that you've managed to achieve so far. It's ridiculous that it has to be an uphill battle, but I suppose that's the way it is, I'm afraid, now in the West, as we all line up to join the army to fight Russia.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.